Women the Engineer would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians and owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded, the Yagara and Turrbal people of Meanjin. We pay respect to their elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. Okay, happy Friday and welcome to another episode of Women That Engineer, a podcast to empower female engineers to break the bias one story at a time. I hope you're having a good day wherever you are and thank you for listening in. Today I have another great chat lined up. Today's guest has over 20 years experience as a chemical engineer. She started her career in process design and has now transitioned into a risk manager role and focuses on project and technical risk. Jo, welcome to the podcast and thank you for being here. I hope I got all of that right in your introduction.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for hosting me.
No, definitely. As soon as I met you, for context, those listening, I met Jo at an anniversary event for a Women in Engineering Society for a university. And as soon as I met her, I thought, I really want to know Jo's story a little bit more. And I think everyone else will too.
Cool.
Alrighty, well, let's get straight into it. Everyone that's listened to a couple of episodes knows exactly what I'm about to ask you, and that is, how did you get into engineering, Jo?
Well, that was a long story. So I did my engineering degree to start off with as a mature age student, and the way that came about was that growing up in the 70s and the 80s, in a little back suburb, you know, there wasn't really an impetus to push on and do other things, even though I was reasonably smart and did well, but I was always also a bit of a rebel, and so I was always in trouble at school and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so basically I kind of got kicked out of school in year 10.
Okay.
And so anyway, life goes on. Did lots of other sort of odds and end jobs, working in hospo and stuff like that, and then got married in my early 20s and started a family, and was technically a stay-home mum until my second child was about two or three. And I'd often thought about going back and doing study, and people would say to me, why don't you? And I'd go, oh, I don't think I'd be disciplined enough and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I got into doing contract cleaning and working for myself because it was easy to manage that around my children's activities, and so anyway, I got this big contract cleaning for a kindy, and it was the worst cleaning job I've ever had in my life. And about 3 or 4 months into that role, I had an epiphany one day cleaning a toilet, going, used to be smart once, smart again. And I went home that day and I said to my husband, I said, I'm going back to school next year. I said, because I can't do this for the rest of my life. So originally I was going to go back and do physiotherapy because me and my husband and consequently now our family are very big sports people.
Yeah.
To do anything at uni, I had to actually finish my grade 11 and 12. So I did that via Dolt Ed at what used to be Oxley Secondary College. And the first year I did Maths 1, which is like equivalent to Maths B, and English, because I knew I'd need those no matter what to get in. And then towards the end of that year I did a bridging science course. And so anyway, it was during that year that a friend of mine who worked for the faculty of engineering at UQ said, you should be an engineer, Jo. And I went, no, because all I thought it did was like mining or construction or whatever.
Yeah,
I went,
no,
that's not me. But I was always the person that if you walked into a school fete and couldn't get the sound system working, they go, Jo, can you fix it? Or, you know, they couldn't erect a tent, it'd be, Jo, can you fix it, sort of thing. So I, you know, had that capability. So anyway, I didn't think much of it. And then towards the end of that first year of study, she invited me to a thing that was put on by UQ called Jobs for the Girls. and it was half a dozen women at varying stages of their careers and of different disciplines. And the resounding message that came out of that was, if you like maths and science, which I love, and you like working in teams and like solving problems, that engineering was for you. And I walked out and I went, right, that's it, I'm doing engineering.
Yeah.
It also happened too that you don't know the people you know until you start working in that, you know, living in that headspace, that it turned out that a number of kids that were in my son's football team that I coached, their fathers were engineers and a couple of them, their mothers were physios. And all the women who were physios said, don't do it. There's a glass ceiling. There's a pay ceiling. You know, you won't make any money unless you open your own practice, which is really expensive. It's physical work, yada, yada, yada. And on the other hand, all the male engineers were going, it's fantastic, Joe, you should do it. So there was that sort of impetus there, and like a graduate and still now graduate engineer gets way more than a high-level physio in a hospital, for instance.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I thought, if I'm going to put myself through a world of hurt for the next 6 years, I want to have a good pay packet when I come out on the other end.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. So that was a bit long-winded, and one of the reasons why I didn't answer it in the little form you sent me. It could be 2 hours to write all of that. So
no, Val, I really wasn't expecting your story to be the way it is, because you're a manager now and you've had, you know, what looks to me like a very successful career. And I think it's really refreshing to hear such a different story. You know, you were a young mum and you changed the course of your life, and you were a natural problem solver. You just needed someone to introduce you to engineering. And I just love that. I think that for you, it was probably just your life and just getting through it and following whatever was a passion. But to me, I think that that's really inspiring. And to people listening who, you know, maybe are a little bit older and think that it's too late to maybe get into engineering, I think that's a really great reminder that anyone can.
Yeah, one really nice thing is that my younger son, who is just turned 30 at the end of last year, he's married now, but he was, when he first got into a serious relationship with his fiance, she's 4 years older than him and been studying law part-time. And she was concerned about them getting married and starting a family and everything like that. And my son turned around and said, well, you'll be fine. My mum did it. And, you know, and she did engineering, which is way harder than law. So, you know, it was nice to see that, you know, that they sort of reflect on the hard work I do. Mind you, they did remind me about one day coming to one of their football matches after a... I don't know if you're on UQ campus, but a chem eng smoko, being a bit unsteady on my feet. And I said, hey, I wasn't the perfect mother, but here you are, perfectly normal child.
You were a uni student doing uni student things. No one can blame me for that, Joe.
That was it.
I love that. And so how has your career taken shape? You went through that and you graduated, and you mentioned you started in process design, but now you're a risk manager. How has your career shaped? And do you think doing your studies maybe a little bit older gave you a little bit more maturity to overcome some of the challenges that I think the industry throws at everyone, and also the specific ones at women?
Yeah, look, that's a good point there. Yes, being older, there were some advantages. There were also some disadvantages.
Mm-hmm.
I did hit a little bit of ageism mm-hmm. when I first came out, so it was hard to, and it was a bit of a downturn at the time, so took a while to get a job, and you know, people used to say, well, you know, you're too old to be a grad and things like that. Once I did start working, it was so funny because people would come up to me thinking I knew stuff when I was a grad, and I go, hey, I'm just a grad, I'm sorry, you're somebody who actually knows.
Yeah.
But then it also gave, you know, I'd just done 6 years of hard yakka and I was very driven. And I also realised that, you know, not only my sacrifice, but the sacrifice my husband and my kids had been put through for me to do that, that there was no way in the world that I was going to not get ahead in this career.
Yeah.
You know, I owed it to them as well as to myself. You know, ironically, I didn't really hit a lot of sexism. I can probably count on one hand any real sexism issues that I've had over the 20 years. I actually found the male engineers I worked with were at least 95% of them were really lovely. Even the older ones, you know, the older ones were great. I still have fond memories of a gentleman that I still keep in touch with. Who used to call me Young Joe when I was 40, and I go, "Yes, old John." And if they come here and help me with this spreadsheet, Young Joe, and I go, "Can you tell me how to spell this, old John?" and things like that. So we had a lovely relationship like that, and
yeah.
You know, I always found that they didn't really care if you were male or female. They just really wanted to, you know, care about that you're doing your equations correctly and coming up with the right solutions, but were honest and open about what you didn't know, so you were open to learning more. So,
yeah, I love that. I think it's so nice because obviously you've been in industry for over 20 years and there's definitely an assumption there that you would have faced a lot being a minority. And I think it's so nice to hear that you know, feel that you've had such a positive experience. And I think that's a really nice thing to hear for me coming through industry with concerns, because I do go to a lot of events and unfortunately some of them can be quite negative. So that's a really nice, really nice to hear. And
it's so interesting that you say that, because I remember the first project that I worked on was the Gold Coast desalination plant design.
Mm.
And there were only three female engineers on a project team of like 100, and the biggest amount of women on the floor were admin ladies and dock controllers, or working on sites where, you know, there'd only be, including the admin, maybe four of you, and getting so used to, you know, not having to worry about when you went to the bathroom, there was always women. And it's funny, as the ratio of women have increased, I can still remember about 10 years ago I was working and there was a high proportion of women, and sitting in a meeting one day and there were all women and I'm going, oh, my God, wow, this is great. But then I realised that the more women there are, there's the opportunity that you go to the bathroom and there's no free door. So there were benefits about being a minority. You know,
yep.
Ironic things like that, little things which are funny little benefits. But yeah, you know, but in saying that, I've probably incurred unintentional, unconscious bias, mm-hmm. once or twice. And when once pointed out to people, you know, they've gone, oh, I didn't realise that. You know, they were just not thinking, and they thought they were doing what they thought was best for you, rather than actually asking you what you thought and what would be best for you. I think I've really only had one really negative situation, and I don't think it was implemented at me because I was a female, but because of on-site politics and things like that. So
yeah, there is quite a bit of unconscious bias, but I think you would find that as soon as you just say, oh, are you trying to be helpful or hurtful with that, you know, or something kind of along those lines, people go, oh, huh, I didn't realize, you know. So that's great. And so you've been in industry for 20 years, you've had what looks like a great career. What have been, or what has been your biggest challenge, would you say?
Look, dodging dodging redundancies, to be honest. So, you know, every discipline has their peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
With chemical engineering being, you know, focused in either resources or manufacturing and that type of thing, you know, it can be very much affected by the market and what's in boom and bust. And so that was always quite tricky, was dodging redundancies. And to say that I was made redundant in 2009 during the GFC, then I got back and I was working. I dodged a redundancy in 2012 and went to another company and managed to talk myself into a pay rise and a position jump.
Excellent. And, nice.
Yeah. Then I got rehired by the company that I was made redundant from in 2013. And did a number of different things there. And then there was another slump at the end of 2014, and I could see the redundancy coming. I was already looking for jobs and things like that. And when the redundancy came, they were so surprised at how well I took it. And I went, well, you know, I could see it coming.
Yeah.
You know, I was made redundant technically by the same company, even though it changed hands twice. Yeah. In a 5-year period. Where did I go to after that? Oh, then I got into the university sector, and was working part-time, and don't think I've had to worry about redundancies since then. But yes, you know, but there's always this boom and bust.
Yep.
And even currently where I am now, we've had to let a number of staff go because there's been a little bit of a downturn towards the end of last year, and that all has to do with the price of nickel and, you know, things like that. So so there's that. I suppose if you were a civil engineer, you know, infrastructure has boom and bust times as well. Probably, you know, people are always building things, so you're not as heavily hit as what you are in the resources sector. So.
Yeah, that's such interesting insight. Personally, I feel like I don't know too much about redundancy, but it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's when often there's like a change or a restructuring in the company to better match the market and they get rid of that role. Can I ask, I think there's definitely a fear factor with redundancies. How did you see them come in? Do you keep yourself up to date with the industry so that you kind of know what's changing and what to expect?
Look, first one, we were concerned. So the GFC started sort of in the middle to end half of 2008. And so there were concerns then.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody felt that, you know, we'd be all right, we'd see it through. And during the GFC, the two biggest areas that were hit were engineering projects and finance. Because the GFC happened because the bottom dropped out of the finance market, first in the US. I've just got a note. So we thought we're okay. And then I can remember, because it was around April 2009 that it happened. I can't remember the exact date. But earlier in that year, that our business unit manager said, look, you might need to think of creative ways, you know, going to part-time and stuff like that for us as things get tight. And I went to them and I said, oh, I'm happy to work 3 or 4 days a week. And I even had project work and stuff like that. But then there was a decision made much higher up in the company that they would start making their process engineer roles in that particular business unit redundant, because I worked in the power and heavy industry business unit of that company at the time. And so it was a multidisciplinary team. And I remember when I first got hired, it was because I'd been doing some research into renewable fuels and they wanted to go down that track. But, you know, I got used on all sorts of jobs while I was there. And so when it did come, everybody was in tears because, you know, we were a really tight-knit group. My business unit manager and my direct supervisor, they were all really upset. I was upset. But they did say they handled it really well. They said, look, you know, we're going to still try and find you somewhere else in the company to work. And over the next month, you know, you can either stay at home, we'll still pay you, or you can come into work and, you know, and if we find something, we'll let you know. So I just stayed at work. They gave me taxi vouchers on that day, which I actually kept for the last day, so I didn't have to drive home from work and we could all go out for lunch. And then, you know, they organised, there's like these agencies that help get your CV all polished up and all mm-hmm. of this sort. So I did all of that the first time round. But the GFC was so bad, I was out of work for about 10 months.
Yeah.
And it was getting pretty dire. So I had to take on little part-time jobs, very similar to like when you're at uni, just to, you know, get the mortgage paid and things like that. But then I eventually, you know, the market started to pick up again and I got a job for a small firm. And it was lucky because that I had the specialised skills that they were looking for to support a project. And so that sort of got me in there. I only stayed with them for about 11 months because I could see that they didn't really have the structure in the company to continue doing design projects.
Yeah.
And they were just doing basically like service work for smaller companies, and I thought, oh, that's as boring as. So, and I wanted to get some commissioning experience, and so yep. I the company to be able to do that. But then, you know, I saw the downturn coming in 2012 because I was a little bit more wiser then. I listened to more conversations about how things behaved, and you know, people would compare, oh, this is what happened during the GFC and this is how the company got through mm-hmm. and stuff. But the second time I actually took a voluntary redundancy. So they gave the staff a good notice, you know, I think it was about 2 or 3 months notice that if things didn't improve that they would be making cuts. And there had been a company that I had conversations with on and off, but they hadn't quite found me the right role. So when they offered the voluntary redundancies, I actually gave that contact person a call and I said, hey, you know how you've been trying to get me in? If you're serious about employing me, things are afoot where I'm working at the moment and we need to act quickly. And so they did. And so that worked out. And so went over to there.
Yeah.
And then ironically, with the second redundancy with the same company, the company had been bought out by another company,
mm-hmm.
and they're having this 12-month transition period. So the company that the original company was a privately owned Australian built company, and so had a certain type of culture, and then it was an American company that had bought it out, mm-hmm. And they sort of got a bit cocky and they didn't do the transition period for as long as what they said they were going to. And they went, oh, no,
okay.
It's all going well. Let's bring that forward. And so the whole way that they did business, a lot of their clients didn't like and they weren't winning work. And they also restructured the company. So for the first time ever, I was sitting in with a whole pool of process engineers. And I'd never really been used to that. I'd always sat in multidisciplinary teams. And so, you know, we would hear of different work going around and we, you know, the team would win work together. And that team, because they were predominantly in power and infrastructure, they would occasionally say, hey, Joe, we've got some process work for you, but it'd have to go through the now lead the principal process engineer, who would then normally filter that off to the grads or someone cheaper. Because I was in the middle, I kept on missing getting the work. So I think I had come back from commissioning into this new restructure, and over about a 3-month period, only had 26 hours of billable work. So I knew it was going to come.
Yeah.
I think the biggest thing you learn from a redundancy is to, one, don't take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
to something that someone said to me, love your work, but don't fall in love with your employer.
Yeah.
So you don't have that heartbreak when you have to separate. And always look as a redundancy, as an opportunity to try something new and a door opening and a new beginning rather than something ending. So,
yeah. Oh, I love that. I think it's been really interesting to hear your journey through that and to get that insight, I think is really great. And I love that positive look on things. And you're such a driven person, and I am not surprised that you were able to get through that and push out and be on top. Hi there. I hope you're loving this episode of Women That Engineer. Want to be on the podcast and share your story? No matter where you are in your career, I and your fellow listeners want to know all about it. Send an expression of interest to the Women That Engineer email, womenthatengineerau@gmail.com, or fill out the expression of interest form in the Women That Engineer Facebook group. Now let's continue with today's episode. The next part of the podcast is talking about maybe some general limitations for women in engineering that maybe you feel we should overcome to get more women in the industry, or even just improve the experiences of women in engineering. Obviously, you've had a great experience, which is amazing. What do you think people could do to make sure that they have a great experience just like you have?
Look, and a lot of the older girls will say this, is that sometimes you have to let things go.
Yeah.
And that. So, and again, I was listening to a really inspiring talk about 10 years ago by, but she had been the first female police commissioner in Queensland. And she said, you have to pick your battles. So, you know, if something is really unfair, you have to stand up for yourself. And you have to get yourself champions and make and don't let people walk over you. But then, you know, there are other times where it's silly little things and you go, oh, really? And you just let them go. And one story like that was in the small firm that I was working for after the GFC, we had a fellow, and sarcastically, used to refer to him as the dinosaur. He was the engineering manager, and we have a weekly engineering meeting, and there was often sexist comments, and not derogatory sexist, but in the sense of, picking on people's appearance or their work. But, for instance, a lot of the guys would occasionally go out west, and you had to have your four-wheel defensive driving, license, but he had a course to do it. And so he would say, you know, he'd talk about who was next on the course. Oh, yeah, because you don't want to drive those cars like your missus and things like that. And those sort of things I would just let go. And this and that. And one day I was sitting in a meeting and we actually had some clients there and I was on a deadline, so I'm trying to review PNIDs, which are process instrument diagrams. And so I'm there and I'm sort of got one ear open doing stuff, and this gentleman, I won't name him even by first name because people might recognize him, said something about our wives spending all our money. And I just popped my head up and I put my hand up and I said, excuse me, I won't mention his name, but my husband spends all my money, thank you very much. And then I just went back to my work. And I just thought, I'm just not going to let that one go. I just can't let that one go. I'm a major breadwinner in my house, and no, I'm sorry, I'm not letting that one go. But, you know, it was said with a lot of tongue in cheek. Our family thrives on sarcasm, so we know how to be sarcastic and still get a laugh. So
I love that. I love that. That's such a good response.
but you know, there's been other points. The one point where I said that I did have a bad experience, where I felt that I was deliberately bullied and picked on because of a perception that I was aligned with another commissioning manager because I'd swapped shifts, not by my doing, by somebody else's doing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just like schoolyard stuff, really. And then again, on a second commissioning stint that I did, it wasn't me personally that was being bullied, but I did witness someone who was a contractor for our company, who was representing our company on site, bully another gentleman, an Iranian gentleman, who was very softly spoken. And the first time I witnessed it, I reported it not officially, but I went and I spoke to my manager when I was on FIFO leave. And I said, you know, I'm not comfortable with this. And everybody on site knows that this guy represents our company, even though he's a contractor. And I said, I'll monitor the situation. And it just seemed to go downhill from there. And I ended up putting in an official complaint on this person.
Yeah.
Because I was concerned with the way that he was treating this particular gentleman. And then I found that he was also, when I was off shift, there was a company graduate that had been put on our team so that they could learn, but she wasn't a process engineer. She was a mechanical engineer. And so when most of the female process engineers were off swing, he turned around and said, I don't know what to do with you. And so she sat there and for 4 days until we came back on site, because 4 days, 9 days, because that was 19 on, 9 off, without any work, because he refused to engage with her, you know.
Wow.
So I have seen it happen to other people. Mm-hmm. You know, I often joke that I've got big shoulders and I just won't put up with rubbish like that anymore. And
yeah.
I'll make sure that I talk to the right person to make sure it doesn't go any further.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. No, I really like the way that you've spoken about that. Pick your battles, stand up for yourself. And I think you made a really great point of speaking to the right person. I think that's really important as well.
Yep.
Joe, it has been a pleasure talking to you and learning of your journey. I was going to say Jory, don't know what word that is, of your journey. And as someone starting my career, it's just so cool to hear about everything that you've been through and everything you've seen, and for you to share your challenges and your highs and your lows. It's so powerful, and I think everyone listening is definitely going to take away at least something from our chat as well.
Yeah, one word of advice that I would give any new graduate, male or female, keep your ears open and your eyes open. And look for the opportunities. When I was a first grad, I used to sit in front of two of the engineering managers and hear them speak about stuff. And it was a balance between letting them know that I was eavesdropping on them and getting the opportunities to hear something.
Yeah.
And my head would go up like a lemur and I'd go, you can do that. And I can do that. And, you know, and stretching yourself and not being afraid to take a chance on yourself and have a go.
So. Yeah. No, that's a great reminder, Joe. Thank you. I will definitely be taking that on board for probably a very long time. This is all we've had time for today. We're going to wrap it up here. Thank you so much for sharing your story. For those listening, if you love this chat, share your thoughts and connect with other engineers on our Facebook group, Women the Engineer. We've also got an Instagram, and I'm currently working on some new things in the background, maybe to do with LinkedIn, so that we can get more engagement up and you can connect with more people. Thanks again, Joe, and talk to you all in the next episode.
No worries. Thanks so much, Lily.
Thanks, Joe.